From Stigma to Strength, Rethinking How We Do Diversity with Meera Charlotte Krishnan.
So thank you so much for having me out, and a special thank you to the District Library. I'm a U of M grad for all the Wolverines in the room. I studied engineering here as an undergrad and also for a couple years as a grad student. I worked in the Center for Ultrafast Optical Science when it was on North Campus. Later, I decided to become a psychologist, and I'll tell you a little bit about that as well. Just to tell you a little bit of my story and how I got mixed up in all of this. Like a lot of people, I went to college and I was really focused on getting good grades. I got involved in a little bit of advocacy, and sometimes I was on the wrong side of causes too, you know, when I was younger. But I remember things like doing Safe Walk when I was here at the university. Then I started working. I worked in the automotive industry for several years, and I wanted something with more of a human connection. So I ended up going to grad school in psychology. I ended up going to the University of Florida. And then I came back finally circuitously to the Midwest for my internship and my fellowship. And I've been in Grand Rapids now for 8 or 9 years. When I finished my training, I got a job at an autism clinic diagnosing children. At first, it was just a job. Like, you see patients and you get kind of interested in their causes. Like, when I was seeing lots of kids with craniofacial disorders, I was, you know, really interested in those kids and the kids with heart disease that I'd worked with. And then I started getting sucked in by the relationships I built with the autism families I work with. And I really started to get this passion that made me think about all these things that I didn't think about when I was just thinking about how to do my job effectively, like what tests had large effect sizes or what was the most evidence-based approach to take in this case or that case. I started thinking about all kinds of other stuff, like how do we support autistic kids whose parents are undocumented or whose siblings have physical disabilities or who are experiencing poverty. During all of this stuff, too, of course, you know, I was thinking about their lives, and I was also thinking about my own. I am transgender, and I had not come out at that point. I came out about 3 years ago in the middle of trying to make this autism center work, and I had really overwhelming support from my families, and I'm really incredibly thankful for that. But it gave me this amazing opportunity to think integratively about how I think about things like feminism and being LGBTQ and how I think about autism. And I want to share with you some thoughts. And if you forgive me, I'm going to weave back and forth between some different categories. And then what I'd like to do after that is talk to you about a model that I'd like to advance, you know, as a candidate for how we think about doing diversity in business settings and bring this all back to business. If there are any, I heard there might be some business school people in the room. And so hopefully I'll keep your attention. So I want to start with autism. Autism is certainly increasingly visible in America. When I was born, which is 1975, the estimated rate of autism was 1 in 5,000 people. And so we were taught, even when I was in grad school, which was not that long ago, that autism was relatively rare, that quote-unquote classical autism was something you might see once in a blue moon. From 1975 to 2014, that rate, the CDC estimate, has changed from 1 in 5,000 to 1 in 68. We think that 25% of that is because we are more accurately identifying autism when it happens, and 75% of it is because autism is becoming more common. And to be really honest, we don't completely understand why that is. We're also recognizing, of course, that autism is a spectrum. For some people, autism makes it very challenging to function in a neurotypical world, which is, you know, people can have labels, and labels can help us understand things. And so neurotypical is one term that autistic people sometimes use to describe us. Allistic is another term that you might hear. But recognizing that the world was, just as the world is built for people who are physically able-bodied, the world is built for neurotypical thinking about social relationships. Some people find it very, very difficult because of autism to integrate into a neurotypical world, and some people do pretty well in a neurotypical world. It's a really broad range. As you may know, just in a 2 months ago, Sesame Street debuted an autistic character. I think her name is Julia, is that right? And so, autism is certainly becoming more visible. I actually haven't played this video game, but there's apparently a video game called Overwatch, if anybody has heard of it, by Blizzard. Overwatch has this character, Symmetra, and this kid broke the internet by writing to them and asking if Symmetra was autistic. And this is a quote from Michael Chu, who is the lead writer. He's quoted in Wired, and he said, "We never wanted Symmetra to be known as the autistic character. She's defined by a combination of different aspects, her upbringing, her specific abilities, and the challenges she faces. We didn't want that to be just the thing, you know, oh, Tracer's the British hero, Symmetra's the Indian hero, McCree's the cowboy, dot, dot, dot. We're mindful of keeping these characters as being three-dimensional and representing a mix of attributes rather than anything in particular." And I think that that's really lovely to see that in a video game and to see that kind of open-ended, multidimensional character. You know, another example I think of in the last decade is one of the characters in the TV show 24. You know, a lot of people would ask, you know, was that character autistic or on the autism spectrum? And they always left it ambiguous, but more importantly, the character had a multidimensional story. I think that that's really important. So there's actually been a lot going on in industry trying to help autistic people in the workplace. I want to tell you this story briefly because it's a diversity story. I want to let me back up a step and give you a little backstory. One of the things I do is work with Disability Determination Services, which is a state agency that processes Social Security claims. We work with the Social Security Administration, and so we work indirectly for the federal government. And we process claims, you know, when people become disabled or if people are applying for disability benefits due to a lifelong disability. And I actually gave a talk about autism to the National Association of Disability Examiners in Detroit a couple months ago. A couple things you should know about autism. Autism, as I said, is pretty common, right? 1 in 68 means if you have kids, they probably are going to be in a classroom with an autistic child at some point in their life. You are probably taking classes with autistic people. You're interacting with them, if not in class, somewhere else in your life. 1 in 68 is a lot of people, right? We have 10 million people in Michigan, and so that's more than 100,000 Michiganders. With that being said, autism is also somewhat infamous as a disability group, and recognizing that depending on how you define disability, autism is not always disabling. Autistic people have the worst employment outcomes compared to other disability groups. And that is true across the intelligence spectrum. So if you measure IQs, right, at very low IQ levels, people with intellectual disability who have Down syndrome or another cause of intellectual disability work at higher rates than autistic people who have intellectual disability. All the way up to very high IQs, you see the same thing. So there are certainly success stories. Temple Grandin is the most famous one of the success stories. But those success stories, unfortunately, aren't the modal experience. And in fact, long-term studies find autistic people in midlife are working maybe 50% of the time or less, and actually are becoming less likely to work over the course of their adulthood. So that needs work. People are responding to this challenge, and I want to give you a couple examples of this to start getting to think about how diversity can be good business sense. AsperaTech is a company located in Chicago. They focus on software testing and bug identification. And I would be really careful because there is a saying in autism advocacy, if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person, right? There's a lot of variation between people. I have a friend who has autism or is autistic, and I'm not going to go into that today, but with respect to the language, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, ASAN, has an excellent article on why people should say autistic person instead of person with autism. So I'm using their language because they told me to. And so I do what I'm told. Some autistic people are very good at certain kinds of repetitive, rigorous kinds of work. They're very good at recognizing patterns and noticing exceptions to those patterns. This isn't necessarily for every autistic person. I have a friend who is a public speaker. There are autistic people who act, there are autistic people who do music and art, and all kinds of other things as well. But this is something that a lot of people on the spectrum are good at. And so this company is really predicated on this idea that maybe autistic people not only can do this work, but maybe they would be better than neurotypical people at doing this work. Because if you're neurotypical and you see a pattern and it goes on and you have to look at it over and over again, your eyes glaze over, right? And I can sympathize with this. I had one of my jobs when I was in college over the summer. I had some pretty bad summer jobs. I worked for Lifesavers Candy, and I had to watch a conveyor belt with candy going by and pick out the candy that was broken. I was terrible at this job, right? Because I couldn't sustain my focus on it. Bug testing in software is kind of like that in a way. It requires incredible rigor. It is incredibly important as well, right? Like, your life is affected by bugs and exploits and weaknesses. Your financial data has probably been breached by Equifax, right? Like, right now, the latest news is that our wireless, our Wi-Fi equipment is all insecure. So this is important stuff. But some key features of AspireAttack, they compete with offshoring options, but they manage to pay decent wages. At least the higher end of that wage range is approaching a living wage. Maybe not in all parts of Chicagoland, but they live in this is in the suburbs, and so it might be livable there. They offer flexible work schedules. They bake in social activities and so like organized outings. This is really important because it turns out that a lot of autistic young people have a friendship network in high school because it's programmed into their high school experience, right? And they've been around these people sometimes for 13 years since kindergarten. But when they finish high school, their friends graduate and move on and move out of town to go to college or to work. And that friendship network plummets. Research actually shows that many autistic high school students have one friend. They're right on the periphery of the social network. And so if you think about having friends, if you have 10 friends and you lose a friend, you have 9 friends, and that hurts, right? If you've ever had 10 friends and you've lost one, it hurts. But if you have one friend and you lose a friend, and now you have 0 friends, that's a very different isolation picture. And that happens too frequently to young autistic people. So organized outings and social aspects. So recognizing that if autistic people can adapt to getting their social needs met in a workplace, in a working life, then work is not going to work for them. And then the idea that, some people may go on to build a career. Like, maybe they want to become developers or work in another aspect of tech. They've had excellent coverage, so you can find out more about AspireAttack in Time Magazine, Daily Mail, HuffPo, et cetera. There are other programs like this. SAP and Microsoft are two big tech companies that do this as well. SAP set a goal to have 1% of its global workforce be autistic by 2020. That's a 65,000-person global workforce, so about 1,000 autistic people by 2020. This actually didn't start here in the United States. It started in SAP India, but it's scaled out to other countries. It's been replicated in Silicon Valley. Microsoft, I believe, based its program in part on SAP's program. And again, you see these supports like buddies and mentors and social activities, as well as job coaching. Recognizing particularly with the autistic community, right, thinking about specific challenges that they have, the kind of coaching that they may need to have may need to be tailored to their challenges. And so one of those challenges might be that a lot of autistic people don't read between the lines very well, meaning that one of the challenges is understanding what other people are thinking and feeling. Autistic people are really nice people, good people, but when it comes to understanding the subtleties of what other people think and feel, they struggle with that. To give you an example of that, at a young age, I have a patient who is from a Spanish-speaking family, and his parents were watching Univision, and it was one of the telenovelas, and there was a fight on the telenovela. People were yelling at each other, and this happens in telenovelas. he didn't understand the context, right? Like, he doesn't get the idea that it's a TV show, that maybe a fight on a TV show could actually be funny, even while people are yelling at each other, right? Because it's TV. So he won't let his parents watch Univision anymore because he didn't understand the social context of that fight, right? That's an unwritten thing, right? There's no manual somewhere that tells you that it's okay to fight when you're on a soap opera. So unwritten rules that we all deal with at work, like punctuality rules, right? Like if you work in a factory, you better show up a few minutes before your shift starts, right? If you work at a tech startup and you show up at 8 a.m. every morning, they might look at you kind of funny and wonder who you are, right? Because that's not what people do at a lot of tech startups. So programming in supports that mirror the needs of the specific community. I want to mention Ford as well. So Ford has a program like this too. So this is happening right here in Michigan, although I would love to see way more of this happen in Michigan. Ford's program is in a way a lot like the program they have for college graduates. And Ford, by way of disclosure, was my first job was at Ford as an engineer. So Ford's program is multi-departmental, right? So they don't pigeonhole autistic workers into a certain department. Again, it offers social supports. It offers an opportunity to get different kinds of experiences with mentorship with a goal of helping people build long-term careers. So I want to switch gears now and talk about LGBT stuff to give you another kind of taste of some of the same story. I want to start with a story of the rapid increase in the visibility of the LGBTQ community. This is Shane Ortega. Shane is a transgender man. He's a trans man who's, he was at the time at least a corporal in the Air Force. I'm sorry, he was a corporal in the Army. He's a helicopter pilot. He is notable because about a year and a half ago, he was the first openly serving transgender service member. So if you're familiar with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so Don't Ask, Don't Tell, when it was implemented, the idea was that lesbian, gay, and bisexual service members could continue serving as long as they didn't talk about their sexuality. But it didn't cover transgender service members who were still separated for medical reasons. Being transgender was considered a disability by the military. So Shane is a trans man who came out as trans while he was working with the military. It costs a couple million dollars to train somebody to fly a helicopter, right? Turns out that Corporal Ortega is actually pretty good at flying a helicopter. So the Army wanted to keep him in that job, and they petitioned the Pentagon. And this is off to a rocky start. What had happened up until a few weeks ago was that the military was easing towards open service with a plan of implementing a specific policy. I have the privilege of working some with the Navy, and what that meant was that there were openly serving service members in some number besides Corporal Ortega. It had gone as far as having draft plans for people getting trans-related health care and other kinds of things. And then, of course, that's on hold currently at the direction of the president, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen with that next. But this is all happening in real time. The decision about Shane Ortega happened in June of 2016, and all of these things happened in between my work training the Navy on working with trans service members happened, you know, mostly in between then and now. And if you had rewound 10 years, not 2016, but 2006, you would actually really be hard pressed to find more than one or two examples of transgender people working in any kind of profession who had told their story. There was one, Jan Morris, who was a famous travel writer in the United Kingdom. And then the second one really was Jenny Boylan, who's a professor now at Clark, I believe. And she wrote her book in 2009, and it was a New York Times bestseller. But that, you know, as early as 7-8 years before this, trans people were not in the public eye in any great number. And that's changed dramatically. We have ongoing changes, too, for the LGB community. So this is Rowan Blanchard. She's an actress. She came out as bisexual on I think Snapchat or Instagram at the age of 14. And she typifies a new generation of LGBTQ people coming out. She didn't come out because she was particularly concerned about how people would treat her. She came out because she saw herself as having a platform, and she saw herself as having the opportunity to use her visibility as a bisexual person to fight against stigmatization and mistreatment of all kinds of other people who were othered for all kinds of reasons. And this is something we see increasingly with young people coming out, and even not so young people like me coming out as well. We're doing fine. That's not the challenge, but it's an opportunity to advocate for other people and be visible. With that being said, the LGBT community faces challenges. This is data we gathered in Grand Rapids about 3 years ago. This is a part of a multi-site data set. This is Grand Rapids data. I don't think there's data from Ann Arbor, but there's data from Detroit that's pretty similar. We had about 400 people. I administered most of these surveys at our Pride in 2014. We asked people some really simple questions, like how accepting is your workplace? And this is the best answer we got for this series of questions, with about 40% of people saying their workplace was very friendly. When I show this to people who are not part of the LGBT community, people will say, well, you know, like neutral, that's not bad. Like I can work with neutral, right? What I invite you to do, you know, if you're thinking that, is think about any characteristic that affects you, and think about how it would feel if your workplace was neutral with respect to you, right? You wouldn't feel very good about that. Neutral might mean, in the context of LGBT people, that they can be, say, you can be gay, but when people talk about what they did over the weekend with their girlfriend or boyfriend at the water cooler, you know not to share because it'll make people uncomfortable. You know, if you're a gay man and you talk about your husband or boyfriend. Think about this in other kinds of categories, right? Like, neutral for a person with mobility challenges might mean most of the building is accessible, right? But probably some parts of the building aren't accessible. Every once in a while, you know, people will look at you kind of funny and expect you to figure stuff out when suddenly they walk down the stairs and you can't do that. You're neutral for autistic workers might mean that there are a whole bunch of unwritten social rules, and as long as you can cut them as well as neurotypical people, then you're fine, but don't expect any special help, right? So very, very friendly is really what we want. And very friendly is what I had at my workplace, which is a nonprofit here in Michigan called Hope Network, when I came out. But only 4 out of 10 LGBT people in Grand Rapids were saying that that was true for them at work. Their neighborhood was way worse. So the dominant response was neutral, right? Again, what does neutral mean? Neutral means that, you know, you can live there maybe, but people aren't too crazy about it. Your neighbors don't talk to you too much. My neighborhood has a block party, and we're asked to help organize it. That's really important because it's a way that we all know each other. I went for a run last summer once, and I turned out of my house, and there was a little boy sitting in a shopping cart, strangely. And there aren't a lot of shopping carts in my neighborhood. Just on the side of the road. Happy as a clam, you know, and I recognize this is kind of strange, right? And so I stopped, right, to make sure that he was okay, which is what decent people do, right? But you all hear the stories where people don't get involved, right, because they stick to themselves. He's the son of a person I know down the street. And so I waited for her to come, and she came running, right? All things that you would do for your neighbor, but all things that are much more likely to happen, you're much more likely to do for your neighbor if you live in a very friendly neighborhood, right? In Grand Rapids, 2 or 3 years ago, there was a neighborhood where somebody painted a swastika on somebody's garage door. And the neighborhood responded by throwing a block party, right? Because their idea was if everybody got together and knew each other, they would take care of each other and the community would be tighter. They would show solidarity against anybody who would do something awful like that, right? These aren't things that neutral relationships foster, right? These are things that friendly relationships foster. And what LGBT people in Grand Rapids were saying was, you know, most of us aren't experiencing this in our neighborhood. My friends at Dow DuPont, who are in LGBT advocacy there, they have an excellent employee resource group. And they talk about this idea that if you make an employee safe from 9 to 5, but you don't help them be safe from 5 p.m. to 9 a.m., what good does it do, right? Are they really going to stay with you in your community working for your company if they go home and they don't feel safe in their neighborhoods? I wouldn't, right? And they recognize that their employees have lots of options, and so they work on 5 to 9 as well as 9 to 5. Something to think about for all kinds of differences, including disabilities. And it turns out, the other reason I want to talk to you about LGBT people is because it turns out there's some really good data that it pays off financially. This is a research study that you can find from Denver Investments online. This is just one graph that I want to explain to you. I didn't put up all the details, so I'm going to explain them to you. What this is a sample of companies that Denver Investments looked at. And they followed these companies for 20 years. Zero on the scale is the year that they implemented an LGBT inclusion program. And the vertical axis is relative financial performance. And what they showed was that these companies underperformed prior, or they were relatively flat prior to implementing these LGBT inclusion initiatives, and actually on average outperformed the median after implementing these initiatives. You know, my example for myself was, as I came out, my autism center broke even for the first time ever. We had struggled with 4 years. At the time I was directing the center, we had struggled for 4 years with always being worrying that we'd have to shut the center down because it was losing money. The year I came out was the first year I was able to get us to break even, and we actually made a profit or a carryover for the first time ever. And we grew by 20-fold during the 5 years that I was there. And so I've delivered bottom line results like this myself. It turns out that companies know this, right? The Human Rights Campaign, you've seen the little square sticker on a car with an equal sign, like it's blue with a yellow. It's not a U of M thing. It's the Human Rights Campaign. So the Human Rights Campaign is we sometimes jokingly call them big gay. They are the biggest lobbying activism kind of organization in the United States advocating for LGBTQ equality. One of the things that they do is they maintain something called the Corporate Equality Index. The Corporate Equality Index has changed over time, but it is a measure of LGBTQ treatment by companies. To get a perfect score, you have to do a wide variety of things. Those things include having non-discrimination policies, but they go way beyond that. They include things like having employee resource group, having trans healthcare inclusion, having same-sex benefits before marriage equality happened, engaging in community public advocacy. And actually, they've ratcheted up the requirements over time. While they've done that, the number of companies with perfect ratings has skyrocketed. It is now over 500. And to give you an idea that these are companies that perform financially, not companies that perform poorly, in the Fortune 100, this data is a couple years out of date, it's actually higher now, but when the last time I looked in the Fortune 100, 83 of those companies had a perfect rating on this index. In the Fortune 500, something like 300 of those 500 companies had a perfect rating on this index. So not only are big companies recognizing that there is good business sense in doing this, but the bigger and more successful those companies are, the more likely they're able to do these things. And we've seen big companies that were holdouts like ExxonMobil even make progress. If it's not perfect, they're making progress towards this. So in the business world, LGBT inclusion is a hot button political issue right now, as are a lot of other things. But in the business world, this is not really a topic of conversation. The business world recognizes that this is good business sense. With that being said, we also recognize that it's a playing field issue for attracting and retaining great talent. Something like 19 states have non-discrimination laws or ordinances, and it's a patchwork. There are also lots of cities, counties, locales. So Saline was the newest city in Michigan to pass a gender identity and sexual orientation non-discrimination policy. Some cities have had those for decades. And so East Lansing was the first Michigan city to have a sexual orientation non-discrimination policy. Grand Rapids was the first Michigan city to have one that included gender identity as well. Grand Rapids was actually the second city in the country after San Francisco to do that. We do not, however, have a statewide policy. The only thing we have is an executive order not to discrimination in public employment. So if you work for the state. I'm on the board of Equality Michigan, which is a statewide organization advocating for a change in that. We tried unsuccessfully to change the law a couple years ago. We're working on changing hearts and minds and getting people ready to do this in the future. We have strong business support. You see this in other states as well. Like with the bathroom bills in Texas and in other places, you see strong, almost unequivocal support from businesses against those kinds of moves and in favor of non-discrimination ordinances. We'll get there in Michigan, but we have a ways to go. Now let me talk a little bit about women and feminism. Ostensibly a good picture, right? Because mostly women. This is news anchors on Fox. Not, you know, picking on Fox particularly, because this isn't a problem that just extends to Fox. But you see a pattern, right? And in feminism, we talk more and more about recognizing that women have different experiences, right? And so if you are a woman of African ancestry and you're a woman of European ancestry, there are differences in your experience by virtue of your ethnic experience, by virtue of what people call race and use to discriminate against you if you come from a minority group. And all kinds of other subtle factors, right? And so sometimes even when women show up, this picture sends a really specific message about what women should look like, right, to be included. Because lots of women aren't blonde, right? Even lots of European women aren't blonde. Yeah, right, right. Well, there's that too. But again, see, like, that's a good example because, like, so if a woman of European ancestry who has brown hair bleaches it, that's seen differently than when a African American or Black woman bleaches her hair, right? It's seen as more authentic in some ways. But so we're focusing more and more on understanding the details. It's not always a victory just when women step up because the policies have to back up the ideas. And so, you know, a really visible example of that would be Marine Le Pen in France, right? And another one, I mean, who maybe is not as extreme as Marine Le Pen would be Theresa May in the United Kingdom. It doesn't necessarily mean that having a woman there is the same thing as having pro-women policies. But we're recognizing more and more that we have to dig deeper. And on the other hand, we're also recognizing that, you know, just having a woman in the room can make change in and of itself, right? And so with all of the problems that Fox has, you have probably seen a clip of Megyn Kelly calling out sexism, right? And if Megyn Kelly weren't there, maybe nobody would have called it out. Have you seen this project? This picture is out of Elle. This is a photography project. And so a photographer decided to take images from politics and see what happens when you excise the men, right? And so here is this picture with just the women, right? And it looks really ridiculous. And there's another one where it's Hillary Clinton, right, in a sit room conversation, and she, I think, is pretty much the only woman there. And so when she's suddenly talking to nobody when you take all the men out of the picture, right? So we've been doing a lot of this kind of education, but we still see that. Across the board, you know, there aren't enough roles for women in film, right? If you've heard of the Bechdel test, right? The Bechdel test is this really miserably low bar. And think about if you apply the Bechdel test to film and you apply it to people with disabilities, right? Like, the Bechdel test is that a film should have two women in it, they should talk to each other, and they should talk to each other about something other than a man. Right, and if you pass this bar, then you meet some very minimal notion of not being really sexist, right? And very few films meet this bar. Think about the same thing with people with disabilities, right? How often are there multiple roles for people with disabilities in a film. How often are there roles in which people with disabilities are talking to other people with disabilities? You don't see that, right? There's a statistic about the upcoming Black Panther film about, you know, how like there are more Black characters in Black Panther than like in everything else that's coming out this year put together. So these issues still occur, and we're working on making them more well known. And in feminism, a lot of the focus is on understanding that people don't just experience one of these things oftentimes. They experience multiple categories or experiences. That's called intersectionalism. It was coined by law professor Kimberly Crenshaw. But it was coined by her to explain something that was really obvious to people to whom it wasn't really obvious, right? And so it was coined in that case by Black women to explain a concept to women of European ancestry, which was that it's hard for a Black woman to think about being a woman in isolation from her ethnic experience or racial experience, right? So the same thing happens with disabilities, right? If you're a woman with a disability, it's hard to think about the one without the other. So with that being said, there is more and more evidence, and it's coming from all kinds of interesting sources, that businesses and economies thrive when they embrace diversity. This is a really long quote, but it's kind of cool. So what Ashraf and Galore did was they looked at geographical isolation of pre-industrial city-states, right? So hundreds of years ago. And what they found was that prior to industrial civilization, it was actually a good thing when groups were isolated for a variety of reasons, maybe because they didn't get exposed to pathogens, you know, from outside their culture. But then starting with the Industrial Revolution, it started being a significant negative to be geographically isolated. And so starting with the Industrial Revolution and into modern times, these locales that were geographically diverse, that were in contact with the rest of the world, like port cities, actually outperformed the relatively isolated places. This is gender data. And so the global gender gap is an economic metric that looks at the welfare of women versus men in different countries. And what this shows is that GDP per capita correlates actually pretty strongly with low gender gaps. And so in general, the highest GDPs are attached to the countries with the lowest gender gaps. And so you see Iceland, for instance, as having the lowest gender gap. And they're relatively higher than the vast majority of developed countries. There are some outliers, right? If you're familiar with statistics, outliers are normal. So there's a really strong correlation between low gender inequality and high economic performance. And it turns out this is true for other kinds of factors also. So this is a little anecdotal, but this is Pew Research data from 2014. And here you see the countries with very high religious diversity and their five-year GDP growth compared to the world average. And you see that countries with religious diversity actually do better economically, right? Now, not every country toes that line, and some of them might surprise you. Like, you might not think of China as being a religiously diverse country, but it actually is. And certainly, you see some of these countries might surprise you. Like, you know, Marketplace on NPR doesn't talk about Togo or Suriname very often. But these countries actually have GDP growth that outpaces their peers that are less religiously diverse. All of this, of course, also affects the American economy by virtue of the fact that America's diversity is changing over time. And in fact, you don't need to read this, but the U.S. population is growing, right? So we're projecting 374 million people by 2050. And 90% of that growth is in the minority communities. And oftentimes that growth is misunderstood. And so immigration is a hotbed issue right now. But like, if you look at the growth in the Hispanic community, most of it is Hispanic kids born in the United States. It's not kids immigrating to the United States. That community has reached a threshold where more is happening here than via immigration. For other communities like, you know, Indian Americans, it's more via immigration. So we're going to see changes in the American landscape. And these circles show where people are concentrated. And you see that ethnic minority communities have a different geographical distribution than Americans of purely European descent. And they have different age distributions also. So like when I did autism work, I talked a lot about this, and I don't direct Hope Center for Autism anymore. But when I was there, I talked about putting in place an initiative to get a bilingual staff because we were serving so many kids from Spanish-speaking families. And the data bears that out, that that's something that is likely to accelerate over time. And my Spanish is still not very good, but I've been working on it. So one more example is that America is getting grayer, right? And so age demographics are also changing. There was a news story on NPR yesterday about how athletes are playing in their sports longer and longer. And so you have tennis champions in their 40s, right, which was unprecedented. They would have been retired for sure 20 years ago. You have football players who are still playing into their 40s, very good football players, and other sports as well. 40 is, you know, the new 25 for athletes. 70 is the new 50 for corporate America, right? So in the meantime, also for those of you who are millennials in the room, millennials are coming into dominance, right? And so the dominant component of the workforce is going to be millennials. And the collision of millennials entering the workforce in larger numbers and baby boomers not retiring is something that some of you may have struggled, maybe dealing with as a struggle, but it's changing the workforce significantly. And actually, it turns out that millennials and boomers have a lot in common. You both value flexibility in the workplace. You both value more options. And some other things also in terms of work-life balance that actually potentially tie millennials and boomers together. And that's changing the workplace too. And so workplaces have to think about working with a broader age spectrum. This is from Ann Hewitt. It turns out that older workers, for instance, are very highly engaged. More so, watch the scale, right? So it's only 5%, but more so than other age bands. And so from a retention perspective, it can be really good for a business to be thinking about older workers. They're very, very motivated. So here the difference is even more pronounced. Or even here you see 81% is really fantastic motivation. And so we're thinking more and more about working with a broader age range as well. So this is kind of a survey of how we're changing our thinking about different groups of people who are minorities or other in the workplace and in American life. What I want to do now, if it's okay, is switch gears and try to tie this into a way of thinking about diversity. So where is diversity going? And I want to show you some things that are happening kind of in the forefront of the way we think about diversity, but then maybe even ask how we can push it a little further. So some terms. Diversity is often defined something like this. So individual group and group differences that can be engaged in the service of an organization. So recognizing that we're not all the same and recognizing that there can be value in the fact that we're not all the same. You'll hear two related terms to diversity. So the next one is inclusion. Active, intentional, ongoing engagement with diversity, right? So if diversity is recognizing that there can be value in differences, then inclusion is engaging so that those differences can be utilized in the workplace. And then finally, equity. And so equity is the creation of opportunities to have equal access to growth opportunities, resource networks that are capable of closing demographic disparities in leadership roles in all spheres of the organization, right? So you think about a lot of organizations and you see that equality is not even, right? And so I'll pick on Hope Network, where I used to work. A really lovely organization. I still do work with them. I value them really highly. But they have a problem that is very common in a lot of companies, which is that there are lots of women working. And in fact, so if you look at their workforce at the line level, it's probably 80% women, right? When I ran my autism center, our problem was we had a lot of difficulty finding any men to work on our staff. And we wanted some gender diversity. When you look at the managers, still relatively dominated by women. When you look at the junior executives, you know, still a lot of women. When you look at the C-suite, though, all men of European ancestry, right? And you see this really commonly in companies where you see diversity at some levels, but you don't see diversity at all levels, right? The boardroom doesn't look diverse, but the line workers look diverse. And so equity is about thinking about the whole organization and making sure that you really have access to the whole thing and recognizing that there are sometimes unwritten rules, right? Back to my autism example of people may have trouble navigating unwritten rules. There may be, you know, old boys clubs, there may be mentorship networks that are informal. So thinking about how people have access to all of these things, right? And so, like, if you think about disabilities, you know, likewise, if your company is, you know, totally ready to work with customers who have mobility challenges, right? Are you also ready to have a senior executive that has the mobility challenges? Or do you also work on having board members who have those things? Or is it only at certain levels of your organizations where you make these things happen? So Verna Myers has this quote that you may have heard before, that diversity is being invited to the party, but inclusion is being asked to dance. And this is important. If you went to a junior high school dance and you sat on the side, right, like you have some kind of idea of what this might feel like. A lot of people from minority groups and people with disabilities oftentimes feel like they're invited to the party, but they're invited as a token. You know, they're the one person in the organization that has this kind of difference, or they're not asked to dance. Like, they're just there in the room. They're not listened to. They're not given the promotional opportunities. They're not taken as seriously as other people, right? And why is that? There are a lot of reasons, right? One of them is that we tend to hire people like us, right? And so that perpetuates a lack of diversity. We have implicit biases against minority communities. And so, like, a really simple example of that is that we think that people who are bigger, right? Some people identify as fat and some people choose other kinds of terminology. But we think that people who are obese are less smart than people who are thin, right? That is pretty irrational. The correlation between weight and intelligence level is pretty weak, right? But we think that, right? And it doesn't matter that we would never say that out loud, because we make decisions based on that factor without even realizing that we make those decisions, right? And those decisions lead to people not being asked to dance. So you may have seen this if you're on social media as well. And so this is, I borrowed this from the Center for Story-Based Strategy. So here's another representation of equality, equity, and here they use the terms equality, equity, and liberation. And so these people are watching a baseball game, right? And equality means everybody has the same box to stand on. Recognize that this example is a little ridiculous, but it can be instructive, right? But so here in this overly simplified picture, the problem with the boxes is, of course, is that for one person, the box is insufficient to reach over the fence and see, right? And for another person, the box isn't even necessary, right? And so we do this all the time, right? Like, we give tax incentives to affluent people, right? And so Warren Buffett is famous for saying, I'm rich, I don't need to pay less taxes, right? I shouldn't pay a lower tax rate than my secretary. But we do that, right? We give help to people who don't even necessarily need help. We don't necessarily give help to people who do need help. You know, and again, this isn't a Republican or a Democratic thing, but it is in the news right now, right? And so, like, if you think about equality, you know, the debt picture in Puerto Rico and Texas is probably a really good example of that. Puerto Rico has a relatively small debt situation compared to Texas. But we talk about Puerto Rico's debt all the time. So we give people equal amounts of help, whether or not they need it. That's equality, right? It's not very effective. It doesn't solve any problems. Or rather, it solves some problems, right? I should be careful about that. If you are this person, right, equality is pretty good for you. Not for this person, but for you, right? And if you're this person, well, I didn't need a box to stand on, but it doesn't hurt me any, right? So it's not too bad for you either, right? And it's easy to say that you know, equality is great for 67% of the people in the picture, right? But it's not so great for 33%. So the next step up is, what about if the boxes are adjusted by height, right? And so we give the person who's shorter more boxes, right? And now everybody can look over the fence. And in this hypothetical example, the third scenario is, why do we have a fence, right? Maybe we don't need a fence. And if we didn't have a fence, we wouldn't need boxes, right? So we've created our own problem. And this happens, right? Like, this happens, like, when we ask people to fill out handwritten applications that are 10 pages long, right? Like, why do we do that? Maybe we don't need to do that. Maybe we are asking about information that's irrelevant to our decision-making process, right? Like, tell me the last 10 jobs you worked, right? And you don't even pay attention to the answer. So there might be some opportunities for liberation, and it's a really good thought experiment. Now, of course, right, in this really oversimplified example, you might say, there's a fence so you don't get hit by a fly ball, right? There's a fence so that you can define what a home run is, right? Like, that's why there's a fence, because it looks like these people are standing in center field, if I'm following the sports analogy correctly. So maybe there's a reason why there's a fence, but you could ask, like, so maybe there could be a net instead of a fence. I don't know. But the point is, you should add, we would think critically about why these barriers exist and why they're necessary. You know, so a good example would be, like, say we're building a new room in place of this room. So this room has a ramp on one side and stairs on the other, right? People without mobility challenges don't need stairs, right? They can use ramps just as well as anybody else. So you might ask, well, why are there stairs, right? So that might be an example of this. If there were only ramps, right, then there would be maybe less stigmatization of people who needed them. So some people like to talk about diversity in multiple dimensions and recognize that, for instance, when we think about diversity, we go one step beyond this. There is inherent and acquired diversity, right? So you talk about nature versus nurture. On the radio today, one of the radio programs in NPR was talking about epigenetics, right? And so if you study biological science of any kind, you know that nature versus nurture is a dumb question, right? Because almost everything is nature and nurture. There are a handful of things that are nature without nurture, but almost everything, it turns out, is epigenetic. So inherent diversity is diversity of background, right? It's what you bring to the table beforehand, right? And so if you come to a company and you have a disability, or you're from an ethnic minority community, or you're queer, or whatever it is, that might be inherent diversity. But you also acquire diversity over the course of your life and work experience. So for example, I'm talking to you from a microphone right now. I have a condition called Meniere's disease. My Meniere's disease is super mild. And so I want to be sensitive to people for whom this can be a really debilitating condition. But I was in an internship when I finally got a diagnosis. I have very poor hearing in one ear. I have been at a lot of talks where people are like, y'all don't want me to use the microphone, I can project, right? But a lot of rooms, and I don't know if this is one of them, nowadays have something called a T-loop. And if you have hearing loss, you know what this is. A T-loop is a technology that allows for basically a private channel so that people with hearing aids can have the microphones piped directly into their hearing aid. And if you have hearing loss and you have a hearing aid and you use a T-loop, it's pretty amazing. Hope College is the college in my hometown, and there's a professor there who's a big advocate for this. And he talks about how big a deal it is to go to a concert where there's T-loop. I played violin for 9 years, and so my hearing is functional, but I'm very aware of the fact that I don't hear like I did when I was a kid. So I use the microphone because maybe somebody else in the room has a hearing loss, right? That might be an example of acquired diversity, because I was a psychology trainee when I lost my hearing. Another example of acquired diversity might be if, so I give you an example that's personal. Also, I had an employee on my team whose parent tried to commit suicide while the employee was part of my leadership team. That experience is a really tragic example of acquired diversity, right? They had a new experience. you may have a coworker who has a child with some kind of special need, and so they become an advocate for kids with special needs. That's acquired diversity. So recognizing that we bring diversity to the table, every one of us walks into the room, and I'm not just talking about people who fit a diversity checkbox because you're an ethnic minority or you have a disability or you're LGBTQ. Every one of you in the room brings some kind of difference to the table before you even walk into the room. And if we're in the room together long enough, you're also acquiring new differences that add to your perspective, right? So recognizing that we can use both of these. And it turns out that companies that use both of these experience multiple dividends. Look at this this last one, likely to innovate based on their end user. That's a really important one. I'm going to show you a little bit of a provocative example of that at the very end. Diversity pays off. I said this before, but I'll say it again here. These companies are experiencing all the kinds of things that every company wants: a bigger market, capturing new markets, improving their performance, and innovating based on an end user, right? So you think about all of the companies that have changed the way we do things because they looked at end user experiences, right? I'm going to pick on Uber in a second, but Uber is, of course, one of the major examples du jour, which if you're old enough to use a taxi cab, it's a pain in the butt, right? It's difficult to hail a taxi cab. You have no idea what it'll cost. You don't know if they'll accept a credit card until you get there. And then you have to worry about if you have cash, if they don't accept a credit card. It's just really, really challenging. Or you've had an 8 a.m. flight and you call the cab company and they say, we can have a cab for you in 3 hours, right? So there, Uber is a really good example of innovating based on an end user's need. But it's not the only example, and it's not without problems. Innovating based on end users has changed really, really old economy things. Like Uber is an example of a very old economy kind of service, right? One that existed 250 years ago or more, but being renovated significantly, Airbnb, but lots of other things as well, right? Or taking old things and making them new again. So it turns out, you know, again and again, that you really can, just these checkbox kinds of diversity initiatives really can make a difference. And so the American Sociological Association estimated that a 1% investment in improving gender diversity drives 3% in sales, and a 1% improvement in racial diversity drives 9% in sales, right? Those are pretty good returns. 900% ROI, if you're a business person, you know, and that business plan is put in front of you, and it looks even vaguely credible, you're going to sign off on a 900% ROI, right? So that brings me to what I'd like to present as three different models of diversity. And initially, as I started thinking about these models of diversity, I think I was limited in my thinking, and I thought of them as being a linear progression. The more I think about this, this is wrong. All of our organizations need to be thinking about all three of these layers. I do think that a lot of the most interesting opportunities are in the third layer that I'll show you. So I'm going to start with what I call reactive diversity. This is my terminology. And here I say that diversity is an initiative in response to a crisis. And I do some diversity training as part of my work, and it happens, right? You know, so I get a phone call, we want to bring you in to do some diversity training. Well, why do you want to do that? We had this incident a month ago, right? And we're in crisis now. And so you engage in a response to that crisis. What does reactive diversity look like? Why do you do diversity? Three questions I'm going to ask. Why do you do diversity? A typical reactive diversity answer might be, so I don't get in trouble. In fact, you know, this is the brutally honest version, I'd rather not do diversity. But I've seen what happens in other organizations, or you know, something happened in my organization last year, and we get to do diversity, right? This is reactive diversity. What's the goal? What are you hoping to get out of this? Oftentimes, reactive diversity is talked about in this level playing field kind of language. You know, if they're really being honest, maybe not getting sued is a goal. Not getting sued is a good goal. But so we defined a playing field, right? We know what the goal is worth using the sports analogy. Diversity increases fairness. It makes the playing field level. And how do we do it? So oftentimes at the reactive level, diversity initiatives in their traditional form do work. they're often bolt-on. So we take the organization, we add diversity. So we bring in a diversity speaker, or we have a diversity month, or we have a diversity blog or something like that. Diversity months, weeks are great. I don't mean to knock IAW, but that's often the starting point in reactive diversity management. And you see this in organizations, and so this is a big survey of companies, and you see that they're doing things like avoiding litigation costs, attracting and retaining talent. You see some of these outcomes with just reactive diversity. So you might think about reactive diversity and think, it's past tense, like nobody would need to do this anymore because we live in 2017, right? And you probably aren't paying attention to the news, of course, if you think that. So I'll give you some examples, right? Harvey Weinstein is a good example, right? The latest news from TMZ is that he had a contract, this is not how you should do diversity, where they actually laid out dollar penalties for each time he sexually harassed somebody. And not just like you do it three times and you're out, but they discussed how much he would pay them the eighth time he harassed somebody. And so TMZ's analysis was that as long as Weinstein paid the fine, he was cured of the misconduct and further action wouldn't be taken. So Weinstein could be sued over and over again as long as he wrote a check. And really until this came to light, this is not a problem that existed for 6 months. This is a problem that existed for a long, long time. And it turns out affected a huge number of people. And of course, Travis Kalanick of Uber is another really current example of this, right? So Arianna Huffington on Kalanick, Travis is obviously brilliant. The problem was that the culture worshiped growth, but forgot to think about the rest of the culture, right? And so you hear all these awful stories about Uber, like a rampant culture where employees would use Uber's technology to snoop on their exes or, vet dates or do other kinds of unethical things, right? So this is another example of a company responding to a crisis. Now, this is a super visible crisis, right? But organizations have crises all the time. The hospital where I did my residency had two crises in the last 10 years where black nurses were pulled off of shifts working for patients who didn't want to be seen by black nurses, patients of European descent. There's actually a new case that was just reported at Spectrum Health, which is another Grand Rapids hospital system, of the same thing, right? So it doesn't have to blow up quite like Travis Kalanick or Harvey Weinstein. The reality is that bad things happen if you're in business, right? You screw up, you make mistakes, you hire the wrong people, or you look the other way on the wrong behavior. Even good companies have these kinds of problems, and they react to them. But that's the very basic entry point. That's like the Bechdel test of diversity, right? That when you see, this staring at you, you do something about it. Weinstein's company failed that test for years, right? Obviously. I'd like to move up a step. What about what I call strategic diversity? And here, what I argue is the defining characteristic at this level is that diversity is a strategy to optimize performance, right? As opposed to a strategy to get yourself out of trouble. Right, like Uber, for the most part, from what I can tell, I'm not doing an autopsy, Uber is still in that getting out of trouble phase, right? They're not really thinking about how they can be a better company with strategic diversity. I think there are opportunities there. Like if you've ever read about the experiences that black men face when they try to hail taxis, there might be an opportunity there. So strategic diversity, what do you do? Why do you do diversity? Oftentimes you'll hear a strategically diverse company say they do diversity so they can be better than everybody else to outcompete. Oftentimes they have a well-articulated vision of where they're going, but they recognize that they need the best talent to get there. What's the goal? So again, they have this idea of where they're going. They don't always know how they'll get there. And they think that they could, using a sports analogy, score more goals and do more of what they're already doing better than they could do it without diversity. And they go about doing it not just by bolting on diversity initiatives, but by thinking about diversity as a core principle of the organization and thinking about how diversity is visible at every level of the organization, from the line worker to the boardroom. So it can't be an initiative or a bolt-on at this level, I think, to be doing this kind of strategic diversity. And you see organizations doing strategic diversity. One example is, so maybe you know these three people. How many people recognize all these faces? No? Okay, so Tim Cook is the CEO of Apple. He is significant because he is a gay man running the company with on and off the biggest market cap in the world, right? Top right is Satya Nadella, who runs Microsoft, and lower right is Sundar Pichai, who runs Google. So here I have three men who are at the very apex of influence in tech, right? Two of them are Indian Americans, and one of them is a gay man, right? So you see that organizations can embrace some level of diversity at all levels. These organizations aren't perfect. I don't want to give that misimpression. So as an example, Sundar Pichai has been in the middle of a scandal because Google is the organization where an employee put out that manifesto about how women make bad tech workers, right? And Pichai has been, probably rightly at some level, criticized for not having a very well-organized response. What that means is that even companies doing strategic diversity may still have to react to screw-ups, right? They may not be doing strategic diversity well enough yet. Mm-hmm. But companies do this. This is Dow DuPont, a local leader here in Michigan. It's another good example of a company that's thinking about diversity strategically. So Karen Carter of Dow DuPont has been named to this national board, Catalyst. She talks about how inclusion efforts are really core to Dow's performance. It's about population growth, right? They're focused on plastic in this case, and this is from Plastic News. Their core business hasn't changed, right? Tim Cook is in the business of selling the Apple experience. That hasn't changed much. One more example is Indra Nooyi at Pepsi. So an Indian woman, and her quote, whether you're a male or a female CEO, you have to think about diversity as a business imperative. If you look at the graduating seniors, right, more than 50% are women. If you look at the best grades, they're often women. You have to draw from the entire pool, right? You can't compete if you don't draw from that entire pool. Here she's talking about women, but I could use this in other places. Like, when I tell you, education level for education level, autistic people have the worst employment performance, you could see that as a knock on autistic people, or you could see that as an opportunity, right? If you work in a tight labor economy and you find out that there's a group of people who have really poor employment rates, you ask yourself, how can I get in on that, right? So that's what Indra Nooyi is saying. What about one step beyond that? What I am tentatively calling essential diversity. My argument is that essential diversity at this level, when you ask this question, why do you do diversity? The response is something along the lines of, that's kind of a ridiculous question. You do diversity because that's who you are. You don't even maybe understand what it would be like to not do diversity. The goal of diversity is this idea that if we weren't diverse, we wouldn't even have a very good idea of what game we were playing, let alone how to score goals, right? So the difference here is that in strategic diversity, minority communities become bolt-ons to an existing strategy, right? The organization's going in the same direction it was going without us, but we're helping it go there faster. The idea is that maybe you can go one step further. Your organization can go in directions it didn't foresee because of diversity. And then finally, how do you do it? If you're going to do this, you're going to have to co-create at the most basic kind of level. And so you not only can't have to have diversity of every level of the organization, you have to have diversity at every stage in the process. So you see how that is a higher bar yet? Don't have a lot of great examples of companies that are consistently doing this, but I want to show you a couple of very small examples. You may have seen Wonder Woman, right? This is the second time I'm referencing superhero films. You should know that I go to a movie theater about once every 3 or 4 years. But I saw Wonder Woman on DVD. This is a picture from Professor Marsden and the Wonder Woman, the second movie about Wonder Woman coming out this year, and quite possibly the way cooler one. So Professor Marsden was in a polyamorous relationship. That means that he was in an ethical relationship with more than two people in it for decades. And it turns out that his relationship was at the very center of the story that he wrote. And Professor Marsden was a psychologist. He invented the lie detector test. And actually, you know, there's this, as they were studying this, the actors were like, lie detector test, lasso of truth, huh? There are these dovetails between his real life and the superhero he created. So this might be one example. Professor Marsden and his partners themselves brought diversity to the table, and they told a story that other people might not be able to tell. In this example, the diversity that they had, one of the diversities was polyamory, right, as opposed to monoamory. So I have a fiance, and he and I are exclusive, and, you know, that's us, right? But for them, this relationship of more than one worked, and it weaves its way into the way the Wonder Woman story is told, right? So here, he told a story that he wouldn't have told if his diversity hadn't been there in the beginning. This, it doesn't have to always be planned in, it can be organic. So Autcraft is an initiative based off of Minecraft. It's a little example. Minecraft is this video game, right? You build stuff, it's kind of like Lego video game. And some people really adore it. And it has incredible devotion among its fan base. So a dad of an autistic kid recognized how much his kid came out of his shell when he played Minecraft. And he built a server to play Minecraft with autistic kids. And that server became this whole community, right, that took this product in a different direction, because Minecraft wasn't written for this purpose, right? But it took it in a whole new direction that it wasn't originally intended for. And to give you one more slightly tongue-in-cheek example, this was in the news literally yesterday, which is why I didn't send the slides to the library until today. So this is a MIT Tech Review that looks at online dating and how it's changed the face of dating. And on the left is heterosexual people, and on the right is same-sex couples. What I want to draw your attention to is that in both populations, meeting online skyrocketed. But you see how much more so that is true for same-sex couples. Why is that? One reason is because it wasn't always safe to meet a partner in in-person settings as a gay or lesbian person. And also because if you're, you know, 3 to 5% of the population, then just in your local social circles, there may not be enough people for you to find the right person for you. Now, my fiance and I actually met at a bar. He's the only person I've ever met at a bar. Yeah, well, no, right. I'm not going to get into that. But you see how much more same-sex couples are using online dating. So it turns out that when online dating was adapted by the LGBTQ community, they started doing things that straight people wouldn't think of, right? And so Grindr is, you know, the most visible example of this. And if you're not familiar with Grindr, I'm not that familiar with it either. But swiping left and right, I believe, more or less came from Grindr. And the idea of geolocation, so that you could find people who were like in the bar with you at the time that you're logged in, came from Grindr also. And came to heterosexual dating apps like Tinder. This is a new one called Chappie out of the United Kingdom. So this is another gay male dating app. What it has that's distinctive is that it actually has this switch, apparently. And so you can choose whether you're looking for Mr. Right or you're looking for Mr. Right Now. And it's not a disparagement on either one of those two options, right? But the idea is that if you're looking for Mr. Right, then you don't want connections with Mr. Right Now. And vice versa, if you're looking for a hookup, you don't want people looking for a long-term relationship, right? If you're looking for a hookup, you don't want the person who doesn't even kiss on the first date. That is something that makes sense. You know, to some gay men like to hook up, but it turns out actually, and you know, this is long-term partnership. So gay men are also meeting partners. They're getting married to people they meet online, right? So if you only understood gay male dating apps as being for hooking up, you'd really misunderstand the gay male community. But now you think about straight women, right? And you say, well, you know, this sounds pretty good too, because it turns out that straight women like to hook up. Some of them do also, right? So here you have an innovation, right? Really tongue-in-cheek example. But the idea is that if LGBTQ people were not involved in dating apps to begin with, you might never have found this, right? If you just adapted straight dating apps to the LGBTQ culture, it might not have worked. You might have missed a lot of wrinkles about how LGBTQ people date. And in fact, this is a gay male example, but the apps that queer women use are very different than the apps that gay men use in some ways. But all of these have the potential to add things that nobody ever thought of because people with differences weren't at the table. So that's where I want to leave things. And so the idea is maybe we can go one step further and think about diversity as being essential. Thinking about the idea that the good ideas that are out there that we haven't thought of yet, one of the barriers to those good ideas is the fact that we only bring people like us to the table, and so we don't have access to all of the ideas. It goes one step further than having access to the best talent. The idea is that our companies and our organizations may be able to do new and interesting things if people work together across these barriers. And that could be what I did four or five years ago when I hired an autistic person to work at my autism center, which I couldn't find any evidence that anybody had ever done before. Probably somebody has, but I couldn't find it. Or it could be something much more big than that. And it could, you know, like dating apps, change a big part of the human experience. So that's the thought I want to leave you with, which is, how do we keep expanding our notion of what people can be and do, and the unique value that arises when you celebrate bringing difference together? How do we move from thinking about people with differences, people with disabilities, from being stigmatized, from being a liability, to being an asset, or even being sine qua non, being necessary for us to achieve the really cool things that we hope to be able to look back on later in our lives as having achieved. So there I want to stop and thank you, and we have a few minutes for questions.